She calls the whole book The Melting Pot and Other Subversive Stories. And she does write about things that are main sort of central issues of our life, rites of passage in our lives, and things like birth and death and marriage and sort of the big ones. She doesn't write about trivial things. But she writes about the big things in very precise detail and with well-told stories about particular people in particular places. She's from New York, and she's mainly writes about urban things. I read one of her stories last week that people liked a lot, and that was, let's see if I can find it in here, it was called What I Did for Love, and that was a story about a woman who was widowed and how she dealt with that grief and pain of that. Some of you were here.
That one.
So that's around on tape if you want to hear another of her stories.
What is her name again?
Schwartz. Lynn Sharon Schwartz. And she seems to use all three of those names when
What's
she...
the first name?
Lynn, L-Y-N-N-E.
Thank you.
Is the book in the bookstore?
No, I'm afraid it's not. I just found it a week before I came up here. So I didn't have time to order it.
Who's the publisher?
The publisher is... It's got a penguin. It's got a penguin on it. It must be Penguin. Yeah, Penguin Books.
Did she write that book, Songs from the Alley? It's about homeless people. I haven't read it yet, but it's a great big book, and it's Songs from the Alley.
It's possible, but I don't know the answer.
No.
I don't know enough of her work. I know she wrote a novel called Disturbances in the Field, but I did learn that she's written 7 books that are published, so... She's around. The Los Angeles Times Book Review says about her is, in an age where so many fiction writers limit themselves exclusively to the descriptive and the offhand, it is good to have an interpreter of our tribal doings among us, one who holds up the customary patterns of our lives to a keen and thoughtful light. And I do think that's an accurate set of things to say about her. The story I'm reading is called The Last Frontier, and it's a contemporary story, and I'd like you to be thinking in this as I read it about what is the frontier here? What are we talking about? What is the last frontier? And then a theme that runs through the story. Sometimes I think it helps if you know a little bit about the story in advance so that you can listen better if you're just hearing it once. And the theme that you might keep in mind here is, what is really real? She toys a lot, and she examines the question, what's real in our lives and what isn't real? And she looks at this question in a variety of ways to give us some light on it. And then I think at the end she comes to some kind of conclusion about that. She gets somewhere with that question, what is real? So keeping those things in mind, I'm going to just read it, and then we'll open it up to some discussion. I hope you enjoy it. Unfortunately, it's a little bit too long, so I'm going to leave out a couple of short bits, but I'll tell you what happened in them briefly so that we'll have more time to discuss. The Last Frontier by Lynn Sharon Schwartz. For George Madison, it was the final indignity. His wife, Louise, woke first that Sunday morning to find the 2 older children in their sleeping bags on the floor, but the 3-year-old gone. The chair George had placed in front of the door to substitute for the broken lock lay on its side. Louise threw on a robe and ran out into the corridor of the Peter Minuet Hotel, where they had been sent after a fire in their apartment building, shouting the baby's name, Denny, short for Dennis. A torn bag sent a barrage of empty beer and soda cans rolling across the floor. She navigated her way around these, and a clump of children huddled over toy soldiers, ignoring the boy from across the hall who proudly waved a plastic bag containing a captured mouse. When she heard an answering, gurgling shout, she swept through the partly open door from which it had come. The baby, wearing his terry cloth stretch suit with a padded feet, stood near a rickety bridge table where 4 big boys clustered. On the table lay a hand mirror, and one of the boys bent over it, sniffing something through a straw. Denny, she called sharply. The baby, seemingly unharmed, ran happily to embrace her knees. Pig, she shouted at the boy, what do you want with a little baby? No one hurt your precious baby, lady. He just walked in, like you. He's cute. Trash, Louise hissed. Hey, watch your mouth, girl. Take him. Just get out, okay? She scooped up the baby and, nearly colliding with a girl on a skateboard, ran back to their room, where she woke George. We are not staying in this rat hole one more minute, he said when he heard her story. None of her objections, where would they go, what would they do, with three children and three suitcases, could shake his will. Within an hour, Denny and the others, Ronald, age 11, and Cora Lee, age 7, were dressed and had their orange juice with donuts from the box Louise kept on the windowsill. The suitcases were packed, and the Madisons were downstairs in the mud-colored lobby that smelled of ashes and hairspray. George slapped the useless key on the desk before a lean, sleepy-looking man chewing on a toothpick. This is no place for us, he accused. The clerk adjusted the toothpick and lowered his head over his newspaper. Outside the Peter Minuet, George felt a surge of relief, like waking from troubled sleep into blessed reality. The life assigned his family had become an error made in some downtown office. Now that it was corrected, his body expanded in the open air of midtown Manhattan, as if something essential were restored. Then comes the brief description of their searching for a place all day long and moving from place to place and going in to find a bathroom here and there. And finally the light was fading. Exhausted, Louise began to doubt her own eyes. Quite a few people on the street, the children mostly, seemed to belong to another order of reality. A small, antennaed Martian, green from top to toe, pranced by, holding a woman's hand. Behind them, a troop of skeletons. Convicts in their stripes, a mermaid, and a centaur appeared out of nowhere. Ronald glanced at his mother's gaping face. Halloween, Ma. Trick or treat, a girl held out her hand. She wore a silver tiara with a long white dress with stars sewn on the skirt and carried a scepter. Her denim jacket was open to show loops of rhinestones around her neck. George passed her by and pressed his family on. Louise had to yank Coralie by the hand. She was walking backwards, gazing after the beggar queen. Suddenly George came to a halt. They stood in the twilight on a bleak, empty street near the land's edge. The river sent its chill through the air, and Coralie whimpered that she was cold. Outside them was a squat, four-story white... Opposite them was a squat, four-story white building with plate glass doors, a building George had been in half a dozen times over the last few weeks, hunting down mazes of corridors for the secretaries who had ordered lunches. On weekdays, men in business suits and women in high-heeled shoes, carrying briefcases, streamed in and out, but today it was deserted. The baby whined and clutched at his pants. Shh, one more minute. George leaned down to pat him. Just another minute. He rushed them all across. Excuse me, he addressed a guard, fussing with the locks on the door. He was a young black man in a blue uniform, scarcely older than Ronald, it seemed. Would you mind? The baby needs to use the bathroom. Uh-uh. You need a pass to get in. Try the coffee shop down the street. He waved east. Come on, man, George smiled with a certain charm. He's just a baby. This is not a public building. Anyway, it's closing. Which island are you from? Asked George. I can tell by the way you speak. The guard looked astonished and murmured, Barbados. We're from St. Thomas. Charlotte, Emily, you know. American citizens. Are you a citizen yet? Look, I don't care what you are. Come on, be a good fellow. It'll just take a minute. How about it? Evidently, the young guard was not yet a thorough New Yorker, for in the end he pointed the way, frowning. Louise and the others waited on the street for what seemed an unduly long time. When George finally returned with Denny, he thanked the guard cordially. This way, he commanded, back outside. Walk slow. What's in your mind, George? How much longer? Just follow me. He led them around one corner, then another, till they came to a heavy metal fire door at the rear of the building. A rolled-up handkerchief held it slightly ajar. "Get in here, hurry."
"Dad, what are you doing?" Ronald said. "You'll get us arrested."
"It's no crime for a man to take care of his family. You all were cold, weren't you? So come along." He ran jerkily through a dim corridor, the suitcases bobbing at his side. When he found the elevator he used on his deliveries, he urged them in and pressed for the top floor. "This is no good, George. It's crazy. You tell me something better and I'll do it. Wait, you'll see." More dim corridors brought them to a vast, black, open space. George found the switches on the walls, dozens of lights came on. There were square black fixtures, row upon row, high up, imprisoning circles of light like moons dropping from the ceiling.
"What kind of place is this?" Coralie whispered. "A castle?"
It was a 20th century castle, cavernous and divided into sections, rooms without walls, or rather, half-finished spaces trying to become rooms. Tables, chairs, and couches stood about in purposeless groups. Household bits, an ironing board, a broom, a lamp, unattached doors and windows leaned against the far walls. Television sets hung from the ceiling like chandeliers. Coralie danced away and vanished. As from a great way off, her voice rang out, "Mama, a regular house!" Louise ran toward the voice, pushing Denny. Coralie was plunked on a beige couch in an elaborately furnished living room, her feet dangling over a mustard-colored carpet. This room was almost complete. Coffee table, a small, elegant desk, a china closet, paintings on the walls, sliding glass door that led to what resembled, inconceivably, a terrace. And on one wall, shuttered half doors that opened to a commodious kitchen. The front door opened on an outside hall leading nowhere. The children were rushing here and there, exploring. Denny climbed out of his stroller to trail after them. "It's missing the last wall," said Coralie. "It's not a regular house."
"It's got a roof," George replied gruffly.
Louise opened the refrigerator. Empty. "It's not cold, not turned on." She tried the faucets in the sink. No water. But there were a few pots and pans and glasses in the cabinets. Off the living room, George noticed a master bedroom with an ample double bed. The very sight of it made him want to lie down and never get up, but he needed to fix the lock and the alarm on the fire door downstairs first. When he returned, he found Louise trying the knobs of the gas range to no avail. "Didn't I tell you I'd find something? What do you think?"
"I think you need to have your head examined."
The place looked familiar in an unsettling way. She had the feeling she had seen it before, long ago, somewhere else, and not quite so cluttered. "Dad," Ronald began gingerly, "Dad, don't get mad, but we can't stay here. You know what this is? It's not real."
"What do you mean it's not real?"
George stormed into the living room and threw himself on the couch, slapping the cushions with fury. They were soft, unresisting. "This couch is real, ain't it? The big bedroom there is real. You shut up now about real and not real. I'm deciding what's real." "George, take it easy," Louise said. "You're worn out. The bed is real, so go lie down on it. You kids help me with the sleeping bags. Then we'll go find where to wash up. You're all grimy."
"I'm starving," Coralie said.
Louise took the donuts and a bag of apples from her carry-all. "You make do with these for now. I'll get you a good breakfast before school tomorrow." She went to put her bag on the desk and drew back with a start. There was a large framed photograph of a woman and several smaller photos in a plastic cube. Yes, she knew these people all right, but it had been so long. Ronald would hardly remember, and Coralie was too young. Nevertheless, while the children were busy eating, she placed the photos in the top drawer. By 7:30 the next morning, they were ready to leave. The men's room near the elevator had been decent enough, although Coralie objected to the liquid soap. She said it looked like pee, and Louise said she was dying for a shower. "Take your shower at Matilda's," George grumbled, "or at that Mrs. Axelrod's." After Louise checked one last time to be sure they hadn't left any traces and surreptitiously replaced the photos, they tiptoed down three flights of musty stairs, carrying suitcases, stroller, and baby. George adjusted the lock on the fire door before they set off in the hazy sunshine. A cool, watery smell rose from the river, and the breezes at their back were soft, not yet wintry. On the street still lingered a benign aftertaste of dawn. "I'll meet you later at Matilda's," he said at the subway. "You going to manage all right with those suitcases? Ronald, you help your mother." "What about tonight? One night, okay, but..." "Not now, sugar, I'm late." He kissed the four cheeks and dashed. George worked at a delicatessen a few blocks south, unpacking supplies, making deliveries, and clearing tables. His fellow workers were much younger or much older men, several of whom didn't speak English. A few in the kitchen displeased him with the seedy demeanor of people who did not lead regular lives. To George, it was crucial to lead a regular life, to the extent that one was available. Overnight, he had come to cherish the newfound haven for its fluffy bed and its drapes and carpeting, and most of all, for its shuttered half-door between the kitchen and living room, through which food and drink might be served. A nice touch. And then it talks about what they had back home on the island. A nice little home, and he was an electrician, but they would never get anywhere in life. They would live adequately, but not rise. And so his cousin Matilda in New York had been begging them to come so she would have family there. And they did come and moved in next door to her, or in the same building. And then 2 weeks later, the building burned. So then Matilda moved in with a friend, and this family was made homeless. Although both the mother and the father have a job. The man works in this delicatessen, and the mother works as a maid for a different family each day. So now we have the mother going to work the same morning. Since today was Monday, Mrs. Axelrod watched the clock, and Mrs. Axelrod watched the clock. She hurried the children, she being Louise, the mother, hurried the children down the subway steps, and using the map, she and Ronald figured out the route uptown. "You said breakfast, Mama," Coralie reminded her when they got out. "Breakfast, Mama," Denny repeated. "Breakfast, good Lord, how could I forget? It's all this moving around, and that place we stayed at." "Mama, do you know what that place was?" Ronald asked. "Don't tell me, Ronald. I don't know. Want to know more than I already do. We'll go in here for Eggs McMuffin. Come on." After she dropped Coralie at school, Ronald insisted on walking her back to Matilda's, where they would leave Denny. It was clear that she could never make it alone with the suitcases and the stroller. "You'll be late for school." "No, I won't. I'll run. I'm trying out for the track team." He got her into the elevator, and run he did, through the lobby to the front door in a streak, backpack slapping against his shoulders. A good boy, Louise thought as the door slid shut. "We moved," Coralie told Matilda after school. "We moved to a castle." "What kind of castle? Don't you start telling them stories, girl. Ask my mother when she comes back up. I'm not telling stories." Louise entered with a basket of laundry and sat heavily down. "It's no castle, Matilda, just some peculiar place George found." "George found a place? That's real good. Why are you so glum, then? How much rent you pay? Where's it at?" "Downtown." "Downtown where, Louise? 50s, maybe? No address? It's temporary, just till we can find something better." Wiry and shrewd, Matilda regarded her for a moment. "Comfortable, at least? Furnished, or what?" "Oh, very comfortable." Louise curled deeper in the soft chair. It was the first night in 2 weeks that she and George had had a room to themselves. "Then why'd you bring those old suitcases here, then?" "Lord, I'm so tired, I waxed four floors this morning. How's my baby doing, huh? Come here, sweet baby. Was he a good boy today, Matilda?" "Good boy today," Denny echoed. Matilda said, "You want to be secretive? You go ahead. I'm going to fix dinner." Louise turned her attention to Gilligan's Island. A group of castaways had put together living quarters on their desert island. Simple but adequate. Uninterested in the plot, she studied the various domestic arrangements, but they proved of no help. Manhattan was not a desert island. The story was pure fantasy, fantasy characters living in further fantasy, like Coralie's plastic nesting boxes melted in the fire. When George came home, he was not so close-mouthed. "You hear we found a place," he said to his aunt over dinner, "lentils and sausages." "I knew we would. Big place. You could put 20 more families in the extra space. Just wait till I get working on it, and then we..." "Working on it?" Ronald almost choked. "Dad!" "Ronald," his mother nudged his leg. "Well, I'll be looking for an invitation. When you say so, of course." Matilda sounded cool. "Mind if I leave 2 suitcases here?" Louise asked. Matilda stared. "I won't ask you no more questions. Put them in the closet where Delia won't trip on them. She'll be home from work pretty soon, so why don't you go on down to your nice new home so's I can clean up?" George insisted that they stay. There was no reasoning with him. He snapped and sulked if Louise or Ronald protested. Anyway, what could they suggest in its place? It was better than the Peter Minuet, she had to admit. Lonely, yes, after the lushness of home, the warm air sweet and weighty with human life. But loneliness was better than neighbors who terrified you. And George was doing his best. Near the elevator, he had discovered a row of well-appointed offices, and in the largest was a bathroom with a tiled shower. By turning a few valves, he made water flow in the kitchen sink. He even managed to turn on the gas so they could have coffee in the morning, and Louise could fry bread and eggs there for the children. With all the fancy shutters and carpeting, there was no toaster. Once he had adjusted some wires behind the refrigerator, she could keep food overnight for the lunches she packed as the sun came up. She even began fixing simple suppers to avoid imposing on Matilda so often. Evenings, after the homework was done and Denny asleep, they all sat in the living room, gazing up at the TV suspended in air. George had gotten it to work with extension cords. And displaying the sprightly families in the featureless homes, never a picture crooked on the wall or a newspaper strewn on the floor. Watching, Louise would grow faint with unease. The families on TV lived in no real place. Yet, if real people lived there, perhaps it became real. Or could the real people be turned into fantasies? The border between those realms, once clear and precise, was stretching open, perhaps to swallow her like a ravine. Luckily, fatigue cut short such speculation. It was not simply her days at work. The hardest work was scurrying around after all the eating, sleeping, washing, and dressing to destroy every trace of human passage in this place. One night, when they finished supper early, they heard a familiar blithe tune. Buoyant voices singing about moving on up to the east side to a deluxe apartment in the sky. The screen showed a black family this time, the father a runty-looking fellow with a mustache, the mother very handsome in an ample, genial way, and a fine-looking son. The kind of young man George would be happy to see Ronald become. He had thought that even years ago, when he first saw this family and Ronald was a mere baby. It might well happen, too. Ronald had grown to be a clever, responsible boy. They were arguing, the father showing himself, as always, to be a loud and silly man. As he strode angrily about, the living room came into view. George's throat stuck, and he could not swallow. He disguised a gasp with a cough. A heavy silence shaped itself around him. It was almost a relief when Coralie shouted, "Daddy, look!" A shriek for the impossible, the sound rimmed with wonder and protest. George leaped from the couch and bounded off the unwalled threshold of the apartment, past the lights and gargantuan cameras, and as he tore the cord from the wall, the faces were sucked into a tiny white light that died like a vanquished star. "Daddy, Daddy," she cried again, "did you see?" He took a deep breath. The irascible, mustached man on the screen had looked so foolish in his rage. George swept Coralie up in his arms and whirled her about. "Hey, big girl with a big voice, look how heavy you are now. Are you too big to play pony like we used to?" Overjoyed, she swung her legs over his shoulders as Louise and Ronald watched, stiff and silent. Look-alikes, George often thought them. Dark, full faces, keen, orange-tinged eyes. This very moment, those keen glances were shaming him, and unjustly. Wasn't he doing all a man could possibly do under the circumstances? In bed that night, Louise felt the misery in his curved back and put her arms around him. George, honey, we've been lucky so far, but you know it can't last. Anyway, it's just not right. No neighbors, nothing. Like off in outer space, you know? There was only the sound of his breathing. And it's getting cold with no heat at night. Anger shot to his skin to be appeased by her hands. I'll get us some space heaters, he turned to face her. George, she sighed, don't you even hear me? I'll be your space heater, huh? How's that? He kissed her and she sighed again and then put it all aside and gave in. There were few enough pleasures. She did not tell him that the night before, while he and Ronald were out getting Chinese food, an old black woman in sneakers, dragging a mop and pail, had appeared outside. Outside the apartment, that is. In the spacious darkness, Louise pretended was a forest surrounding them. The cameras, bizarre trees and bushes. Hold it, the woman had said, spotting Louise. I must have got out at the wrong floor. What's this here? Four. Shit, I done pressed the wrong button. I'm supposed to do three on Monday and Wednesday. Who can keep track, I ask you? I thought the one for up here came in the mornings. What are you doing here now? They asked me, Louise shrugged. I guess there's something special going on in the morning. The woman had already started dragging her mop towards the elevator. She looked back over her shoulders. You bring your kids with you? Geez, what you young girls won't think of. Louise breathed again when the woman disappeared. From then on, she spent every spare moment searching for a place to live, sometimes alone, sometimes with Coralie and Denny. She didn't like leaving them with Matilda all the time, hearing her pained questions and telling pained lies. When Denny got chilly or cranky, they resorted to what shelter was at hand. She tested the beds in the furniture department at Macy's, sat at the dining room tables and imagined her family seated around her, each one before an impeccable, tasteful place setting, with Denny in a high chair. They might just as easily have ended up here. But Denny got restless in department stores. His favorite place was the Museum of Natural History. Behind a glass loomed dioramas of exotic dwellings, igloos, Indian villages, even the lairs of wild animals. It was cozy and soothing in the dusky rooms encircled by glaring beasts, so real and menacing, yet utterly harmless. And downstairs was a fully equipped cafeteria where they stopped for snacks. It might be spooky at night, though, sleeping in the shadow of dinosaur bones. Coralie wanted to live next door in the planetarium under the stars, but Louise explained that the stars in the planetarium came out only at showtimes. Aren't they real stars? She wanted to know. They're real stars, but in a sort of picture. You can't see them unless they turn on the machines. Coralie was not satisfied with this explanation. Louise was puzzled herself. Over on Fifth Avenue stood a stately mansion, through whose doors passed beautifully dressed people surrounded by an aura. What was it? Ownership, she decided. If only she could enter, she too might move in that aura, where nothing could be denied her. She would care for it well, leaving not a trace in the morning. She knew how. But the man at the entrance said children under 10 were not permitted. That would never do. In the big museum further up the avenue, everyone was permitted. Whole classes of children, shepherded by their teachers, stampeded up in its imposing front stairs. Indeed, the crowd packing its lobby was huger than the crowd at the airport 6 weeks ago that seemed like 6 years, and more avid than the shoppers who streamed off the ships every afternoon to fill the streets of Charlotte Emily. The room Louise loved best, perhaps because it reminded her a little of home, looked like a greenhouse, huge and light, sun streaming in the slanted glass walls. They could eat here in its waning rays, and the children could play beneath the immense potted plants. They would sleep on the long leather benches in the adjacent rooms, or even, she thought in a moment of despair, they could sleep across the lobby on the old stone tombs of kings and queens. She finished early on a Thursday, Mr. Vickers' day, and after an hour of apartment hunting in a shabby district, wandered into the YMCA. There was no hurry. Coralie was visiting a friend from school. The guards on each floor were friendly, and one showed her the heated swimming pool. The children would love that. They hadn't had a chance to go swimming since they got here. There were showers galore in a lounge with soft couches, and surely somewhere there was a kitchen. She studied the catalog. You could learn to do just about anything here, it seemed. She could take up the guitar or photography or ballet. She used to be a good dancer before Ronald was born, when she and George had gone dancing every Saturday night. Coralie could learn arts and crafts, and Ronald and George could shoot baskets in the gym. There was even daycare. Actually, the catalog explained, the daycare was for the babies of teenage girls who needed to finish high school, hardly her case, but they might make an exception. But always there came the hour to return from these excursions to her real life, either to meet the children at Matilda's or to go home. She was coming to think of it as home. Day by day, it housed a life with emerging outlines, and the patterns frightened her. She might be sitting in front of Matilda's friend's TV one afternoon and see herself. Ronald would rush in with a few of his ball-playing friends, sweaty, robust, energetic boys, worrying over some little... Get yourself a good rest. Don't do no more fixing up or whatever it is you're doing to that place. Just get yourself to sleep. I want to go home now, Coralie clamored. We can't, honey, not yet. It was only 5:15. George had said 6 o'clock was safe, but Louise didn't feel safe till 6:30 or 7, and even then, never quite safe. Why? Oh, stop whining. Did you have a nice time with your friend? What was her name again? Cindy. She wants to come to my house. Can she come to my house tomorrow? No, not tomorrow. Why not? Why not? Denny echoed. Louise took him on her lap. He was too docile for a 3-year-old, and she didn't recall the other two children constantly echoing things at that age. This life was taking its toll, even on him. Because I said so, that's why. Because we live too far downtown, too long a trip for her mama to pick her up. She could sleep over. She could get in my sleeping bag. Coralie, we'll talk about it later. What's this sleeping bag business? Asked Matilda. Ain't you all got beds yet? Ronald and me, we sleep on the floor. The beds are coming this weekend, she told Matilda. Huh. Well, stop your bickering. My program's coming on. They done give it a new time. Coralie pouted and slunk away to the kitchen, and Louise bounced Denny absently as the theme song began. The family that was moving on up. There was the heavy, handsome woman with a deep voice talking to another black woman. Louise couldn't remember seeing her before. It had been so long. From the way the lady of the house was giving instructions, friendly and specific, like Mrs. Butler, the other must be the maid. She answered back sassily, though, very familiar for a maid. Suddenly, Denny catapulted from her lap to the screen, his index finger jabbing. Our living room! Our couch! He cried. That lady be sitting on our couch! Stop poking that screen, Denny, said Matilda. What's he saying? Look, the mirror. Look, now our kitchen. There's things on the table. Denny, Louise grabbed him. Stop it. Just when she was thinking, maybe he was a little slow. It's nothing. We have a couch, something like that, that's all. Denny struggled to get free. Our house. Why they in our house? Louise, honey, Matilda turned to her. What kind of place you living in? You got an east side apartment like that? Of course we don't. Matilda sat up very straight. That's why you never ask me over. You don't want no one there seeing who your family is. Matilda, you're talking crazy. How could we pay for a place like that? You know I'd ask you if I could. It's just not fixed up yet. I want to go on TV, too, Denny was hollering. Mama, can I go on TV next time, please? Coralie ran in from the kitchen, shouting, Who's going on TV? Who? I better go. George will be home soon. Coralie, get your jacket. Ronald can come on down by himself. I'll leave a subway token for him. Yes, maybe it's time you went, said Matilda. Matilda, please, you just don't know. Sometimes I fear I'm coming unstitched. George arrived home slightly later than usual that night. He, too, had stopped to see a few cheap apartments advertised in the paper. But there was no point in looking, the supers had said. They're already taken. He was shoving despair to one side like a rampant undergrowth as he stepped out of the elevator to find the place blazing with light. George had grown used to imagining at this point every evening that he was walking home through the amiable streets of his old neighborhood, and he peopled them with faces from home. There, people in town had known him and greeted him, returning from work. Here, it was like living on a desert island, or being the last family on a dark earth after they dropped the bomb. No dark earth tonight, though, but eerily bright, like coming home sick in the middle of the day. He found Louise in the kitchen. "Why all the lights?" he kissed the children, picking Denny up and tossing him about. "It was like this when we got here. Something's funny, George. I don't know. The things outside are different, too." He saw from the kitchen window that the cameras had been rearranged. And out the sliding glass doors, behind the terrace, stood two enormous pieces of masonite painted to show a city skyline by night. "Nah, it's nothing. I'll go turn them out. What's for dinner?" "Hot dogs, potato salad, baked beans." "Okay, I'll be right back. Don't none of you worry." He found the switches and restored the safe darkness. No sooner had he settled on the couch with his newspaper than from the distance there came voices and heavy footsteps. The space outside flared up anew, showing George two tall, youngish white men clumping through his neighborhood toward his house. He stood up quickly. In an instant, Louise and the children were at his side. "Hey," one of the strangers called. "What's going on here? What are you people doing?" "Living," George said. "My wife's fixing dinner. My children are doing their homework. The baby don't do much of anything yet. You know how it is." The intruders, holding cardboard coffee cups, stared at each other for a long moment. "Look, I don't know what you're talking about," said the same man, "but if you go quietly now, you won't get into trouble." "You're at my door, but you're not saying who you are," George replied. "Your door, for Christ's sake! Okay, okay, I'm the assistant producer and this is the cameraman. We're shooting an hour-long special in the morning and we need to set up the apartment upstairs. You get it? This is no real place to live." "It may not be real," Louise said, surprising George, "but we are real." "I'm real," said Ronald. "I'm real too," said Coralie. And the baby echoed it as he always did. "You're real, sure," exclaimed the assistant producer. "I'm not quarreling with that. I can see that you're new here, the way you talk. But the fact is, this is not meant for living in." "But I've seen people living in it," said Louise, "and we're realer than they are." "Well, that's just the point," he blurted. But then he stopped short. "Don't you see, man," George said equably, "if we're real and we live here, that makes it a real place to live." Listen, the assistant producer began pacing and waving his arms distractedly like a character in a TV family. "I'm not going to stand here and have this ridiculous discussion. You don't belong here, and I'm asking you politely to leave. Will you leave now?" "I'm willing to pay rent," George said. "Nobody asked me before. Maybe I can't pay all you want, but I can pay something. We're both working people." An image flashed by him. His ordinary family of five earning their keep by doing their natural lives on TV in front of the cameras. They could speak up loud and clear, act out little scenes, whatever was required. Ronald could be pretty funny when he was in the mood, and the baby was certainly as cute as any TV baby. "It's not a question of paying rent. It's just not the way things work here. Now, for the last time, if you don't leave, I'll have to call the police, and we'll all waste a lot of time." "You're going to have the whole family arrested?" George let out a short laugh. "The baby, too? What for? My wife for boiling hot dogs? My little girl for doing her spelling? Who are we hurting? What kind of city is this, anyway?" "No, man. You carry on with your stuff out there, and we carry on with our living. We don't bother you none. You don't bother us." He would yield no more. The swift image had evaporated. In truth, he did not wish to live on TV, make a ranting clown of himself like the small mustached man who lived on the screen, nor to have Louise showing herself off like the spunky, long-suffering wife. He wanted his real life in the real world, though it appeared to have no place for him. "This is too weird," groaned the cameraman to the other in disgust. "I'm getting to work. I don't know about you, but I want to get home before midnight." He tossed his jacket onto a stool and began wheeling one of the cameras to a nearby set. "Thanks a lot," the assistant producer called out. All in a row, the family faced him, proclaiming their existence, occupying the space as if it would take heavy machinery to dislodge them. "What are you people planning to do? Stay here all night?" "First we'll have our dinner," replied George. "Sit around with the kids, maybe watch some TV, you know." "God damn." The assistant producer made fists and struck his own forehead. "God damn. What the fuck am I supposed to do?" "These are young children," George warned. "They don't hear that kind of talk in the home." "Sorry," the man muttered. "Sorry." So there we're left.
Is that the end of the story?
That's it, Doris. That's the end of the story. Let's talk about the end first, because it really, the first time I read it, I had the same feeling that Doris is having right now. And I thought, wait a minute, you can't do that to me. But I reworked it a few times, and I finally came to the conclusion that it was okay, I could live with that end. What do you think? I mean, why does it leave you feeling like that?
You want to know where they go. What do they eventually find a place to live? Are they allowed to stay there and continue to do it the way they've been living?
We sort of want to hear the happily ever after.
Mm-hmm. What were you going to say, Doris?
It reminded me of an experience we had in Sweden. We thought it was a park. And we drove in, we had a Volvo, and all our kids looked like Swedes. And we drove around, there were a few people working in the gardens and all. And then there was this house which we thought was a museum. Nobody said a word to us, so we walked up to the museum and went in and saw all these family pictures around. We got out of there so fast. And then when we drove out, we stopped. There's a man coming in, and we stopped and asked him. We said, "What is that place?" He says, "It's a king's palace, a summer palace, king's summer palace." And well, we were embarrassed, and we've been embarrassed ever since.
And now there are 40 more people that know about it.
It struck us that nobody came up to question, sure, why were we there.
Yeah.
We just went our merry way and thought, this is a nice place.
Probably thought you were a relative.
I think that was it. Like I say, we all look like purebred Swedes, and we were.
What are some of the other places in the story that they look at, like Doris and Rudy looked at that palace, and like they looked at this set? Do you remember there were other places that she was... The department store. You know how in department stores they have perfect setup rooms and
museum.
The museums, a couple different ones.
And the YMCA. But could they not have lived in the YMCA?
I wondered that too, but it didn't say they rented rooms there.
No.
So maybe not. Some do and some don't. But
I liked the ending. Mm-hmm. I really liked the ending because we want to know what happened to those people. But we really don't want to know what happens to all of them that are out there. We can't handle it.
That's right. Lynn Sharon Schwartz calls this book The Melting Pot and Other Subversive Stories. In what way do you think that ending is subversive? I mean, what is she... What is it? It's a statement about our society.
Part of it is that she lets you know these people. And mm-hmm. we don't know all the people who are homeless, and we don't let ourselves know them, because if we knew them, probably we live...
Can't live with
them. ...where we live and see them on the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And she builds their character, and they all become real to us.
Mm-hmm.
The subversion, I think, comes from the man who... the assistant producer... who theoretically, in terms of real life, is supposed to kick those people out of there, no question, or call the police or whatever. Mm-hmm. And he can't. He's confused. He's living in a non-reality from his reality now too. I mean, reality's all switched around by these things. I like the ending too, because I think the ending's reality. I think that the in. Reality asks us these questions.
Mm-hmm. I think it's partly subversive that she doesn't solve their problem.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, they're still stuck. And that's an accurate statement about homeless people. Yes.
Maybe it's partly subversive, too, in that we have to supply the ending, not only for this family, but for many families like that. Maybe it's up to us to help supply it.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. Well, what sense is this ending... A view of reality. What is reality there in the end, in George's mind?
Mm-hmm. Well, in the statement of assistant director or whatever, assistant producer, whatever he was, in his apology to the statement of, I mean, he's accepted their reality.
Exactly.
He's accepted their reality, at least for the moment.
Yeah, that's what I think is... It's like when music changes keys and then it resolves in the new key and suddenly you accept the new key as being the reality. The assistant producer says, "God damn, what the fuck am I supposed to do?" And George says, "These are young children," George warned. "They don't hear that kind of talk in the home." "Sorry," the man muttered. "Sorry." So he buys into George's reality at that point.
Uh-huh.
And his partner's already out there in the dark, you know, redoing the camera arrangements. And the dark has become outside the house. And it's not all in the same room anymore. It's everyone's bought into this story, that it's outside the house. But it's still we know, and the narrator knows, a third level of reality. Which is that although they may be able to get through this night, their problem is not going to go away. It seemed odd to me that they were able to maintain such a regular life. And several times they talked about how important it was to George. By the way, what are the names of the main characters in that Moving On Up story?
Yeah.
George and Louise.
And they have the same names.
They have the same names, Millicent, that's right.
I think that's part of the real unreal theme that she carries through from the very beginning. The real or unreal and the unreal or real. And it just goes, the twisting of it goes on and on.
Mm-hmm. Why does she do that Halloween scene in the beginning? Why does she throw that in?
Is that unreal too?
And yet it's real. I mean, it's,
yeah.
I think she just sort of is preparing us for a kind of...
Living a fantasy?
Yeah. Sure. And the one that she focuses on of those Halloween kids is the one that's in Unreal Diamonds, in thing of...
In the bigger.
And she's a beggar queen,
and
in the fancy clothes.
A jacket, a denim jacket on top of her beautiful white garment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. With the fake diamonds.
It also shows they're in a new culture, a new set of different customs they have to get.
And is often the case, the children are more up to speed in the culture than the adults.
And the thing that struck me, I mean, Matilda was the only hope, really. But the way Matilda felt very slighted, too, she was getting a bit fed up with this. Why don't they ask me to visit them?
Yes, yeah.
She sensed that something isn't...
So what function does Matilda play then in the cast of characters?
I think she's the only stability. They have jobs, but she's telling.
I thought it was interesting though that she's the one that kind of got them come over but then really couldn't help them.
Well, she was burned out of her home, too.
Yeah, she's on her, and, but couldn't, you know, they had left some security to be with her, and then and she wasn't able to help them.
Yeah, she might have described a world to them that didn't turn out to be real either, you know, the land of opportunity where you can make your way, and obviously that didn't work.
Yeah.
I may have had a different reaction than most, but for me it was a completely, you know, maybe this may be stating the obvious, but it was a very make-believe story. And I didn't for an instant believe that it could actually happen that way. But it, mostly because I live in New York City and I know that it would have been a lot more raw and, you know, ugly and sadder. And I don't think they would have found a temporary oasis in the way they did it. Maybe, you know, I just didn't believe it. So for me, it stretched my imagination because from the outset, I came to grips with that it was fiction. And so, you know, I just imagined, you know, that it could happen and how we feel and how naive they were in the new culture and things like that. But I'm sensing that, that people feel that it really could have happened, and maybe that's another perspective that you could get from this.
But it is possible that what seems so unreal to you can actually happen. That is the thing about life. Things that you that really knowing our particular city where we come from or something like that being, you know, written about, and we say, oh, that's not possible. But then when you stop and think, life itself, what seems so way out can be actually what can happen.
Truth is stranger than fiction. Oh, yeah. You hear over and over again.
Didn't even believe it themselves.
Right.
That's, you know, this can't be happening. Yeah. We can't live here, Dad.
Yeah.
Yeah. They the kids especially and the wife. Wheezy, Louise.
What that struck me was, I mean, there were two people that had jobs and how quickly they went, because their apartment, I mean, when they came, they were okay. They had an apartment and they wanted to get themselves established. And how quickly, just through that fire, there was no other opportunity but live on the streets.
New York City.
Excellent point. I didn't read to you the part where it explained how they got their apartment originally, but it was through connections, through Matilda. And that's how everybody gets apartments, I think, in New York and even in Chicago, a lot of that goes on. But that's, I think, something that Schwartz wants to say, is that this family is typical. I mean, it's absolutely the mean, it's mainstream homeless family. This is not unusual. The fact that they keep the children going to school and that they keep their some level of keeping their act together is because they have those values deeply in them, and they're regular people. I mean, that, and she says several times, she has George say, it's so important to be regular people. And they are, and they have jobs, and they're educating their kids and keeping their kids clean and well-fed and balanced diets. And, you know, but that's, those are the people who are now homeless. And in growing numbers of women and children, I mean, families are homeless more and more. Anne.
The kind of living room that is, too, kind of gives an undercurrent of unreality to our lives, I think. The fact that there's sort of this unreal nature, you know, what we deal with the TV families, and then what does that say about the kind of lives we live? How transitory really are they? And yet how much we put security in that?
Mm-hmm.
And yet we are the exceptions in the world.
And we think that the TV families are the sort of norm and the proper family.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The ones to imitate. There's kind of an undercurrent that kind of makes our life sort of undercurrent.
Yeah, the whole thing's a reflection on our lives. I think that's right. Back to Matilda, do you think, I sort of have the feeling that Matilda is, she's certainly a different point of view from the rest. I wonder whether Schwartz wants Matilda to be the kind of reality check, the our point of view almost as we're listening to this. Why do they lie to her? Would you lie? Would you be lying to her if you were that family?
I had wondered about that. It would make it so much easier if they would just confide in her and have her help them by, you know, maybe helping with supper and whatever every day.
Yeah.
Except George is a really proud man, and I think the last thing straw for him is to admit that he cannot provide for his family. I mean, he says that, well, he says that several times in there, doesn't he? I'm a man, and I, you know, I'm providing. And he can't admit it, I guess, that he can't to himself.
I think that's right.
Maybe I've forgotten, but I don't recall any dialogue between George and Matilda during this time. It's always Louise and Matilda. And I think Louise is a bit ashamed, or it's still unreal to her, and she doesn't want Matilda to know.
That's really observant of you. That's true. George and Matilda never have.
I think they're lying to her because they're lying to themselves, really. I mean, they know that it's not real, and I think that would be... I mean, we certainly all do that about things in our lives that aren't ideal for us, aren't the way that we picture them and want them to be. And so we lie to ourselves about that, and we lie about that. When we can't face up to our own truths, we certainly can't tell somebody else. And I think that's what they're doing. They're lying to her. They have to, because there's certainly an element of lying to themselves about the reality of their life.
Whose image, whose vision is it that's enabling them to do that? Yeah.
George.
George has got such a powerful image. It's almost like he's a camera that's insisting on focusing on something that's about here instead of out there. And so his focus, his image of their life is what eventually they all buy into one way or another. It becomes their reality.
If it weren't for the children, I think the young couple would have managed a little bit, but I think it was the pride in the young parents to go along with the not really coming up with reality with the children. Mm-hmm. Maybe the children knew it, but somehow they said...
Do you remember why they left the Peter Minuet Hotel? I mean, they did have lodging.
Kids
and drugs and
junk.
She came out, they don't have a lock on their door. She came out their door and tripped over beer cans and toy soldiers. I thought that was an interesting thing to trip over.
Yeah, that was bad too, just like the beer cans and the drugs.
And so they left to protect the children. So I agree that was really where they were hooked. They had to take care of those children. And he says several times, that it's not a crime for a man to take care of his family. And, I mean, he's very clear about that, that it's almost like he is in the wilderness or someplace where you just work out your moral framework given what you've got to work with.
She didn't feel they deserved that, though. He was never talking about paying rent or anything, and I'm sure they always talked about that sort of thing. And so that... she just did not feel right. They weren't paying.
No, she didn't, did she? She was the one.
There's also this whole picture of them leaving a fairly comfortable life, it sounds like, and coming to their image of a life where they could improve themselves and grow on. And that illusion, that is obviously an illusion that they haven't dealt with yet. And when he's talking, George is talking to the museum or to the guard and asks him, tells him he knows he's from someplace else and I'm from this place, and we're Americans,
but they're off in the islands.
Yeah,
so there's a little bit of mitigation of racism against them. A couple of times the fact that they were from the islands and not raised in New York worked in their benefit. The racism backed down a tiny bit because of that.
The comment that he makes about a father should take care of the children, it's not a crime to protect them. We all know of cases where you live, I do anyway, where parents are arrested because they've gone to the trash bins at the grocery store, the leftovers that they're going to dispose of, and they get arrested because they're trying to find food their family can use. Mm-hmm. So that statement itself is another one. Our society does that.
Exactly. It's really true. It's interesting, when he leaves the Peter Minuet Hotel, he says, outside the Peter Minuet, George felt a surge of relief, like waking from troubled sleep into blessed reality. Mm-hmm. And already coming from the islands to New York, he thought was going into a dream or something positive.
It was a bad dream.
It was a bad dream, that's right.
and it still is, I think, at the end of the story. But he thought, coming out of that hotel, his reality, his focus had just changed to that hotel and the freedom that getting out of there gave him. And it gave him no freedom at all because he was then homeless.
Yeah. I think people often think, too, that there's a system that would protect each one of us and the others in the world, whether it be police or, find shelter or what have you, food, soup kitchens, whatever it may be. And there really isn't. And without really coming right out and telling us that, they lead us to that point that, you know, you're on your own, and if your place burns down, you might find yourself pretty quickly on the street with your suitcases. So, and, you know, somebody might say, well, why didn't they go to the agency that would handle this? And for one thing, if you don't know about it, you're not going to find it. And even if you know about it, most likely just forms and time involved. So,
well, the agency, placed them in the Peter Minuet.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh.
Peter Minuet is a place for homeless people.
Which was probably just one room.
It was one room, and it wasn't working for him.
But, you know, I had so much dialogue on different programs about the homeless, and particularly in the city of New York. And then when you look at all these housing projects that they board up, and yet they pay this astronomical amount of money to these people with these hotels for these people to stay there. And here they're sitting here with places that are livable, that they could be in a much more comfortable atmosphere and a safer atmosphere.
Certainly
and
the case.
Rather leave them stuck over there.
Our society could house everybody comfortably and safely. That's true. What do you think this last frontier, why is it called the last frontier? And in another layer of that question is, what is a crime in the frontier and what is a crime in this story? Is there anything, I mean, the references to crime are pretty pervasive. Is this a crime? Is it not a crime? Why is it called the last frontier?
I think it's television in the end that's the last frontier almost. It's the latest thing that all our families pay attention to and where we find our normal daily lives, you know, watching our 6 hours a day or whatever. Maybe one of the crimes is trying to be real and address the problems of reality instead of the problems of make-believe on the television screen.
That's real interesting. Thank you. It's an interesting thought. Yes.
I guess I see the last frontier in the story as being the reality that you make for yourself rather than that surrounds you. What you place as your own reality rather than the reality that you make in your own life.
When you think of it, yeah, that's interesting too.